All right, well, welcome to the Base Joe podcast. My name is Neil.
And I'm Steve.
Man, this week we're back to just the two of us.
I know. It was nice having Doug here, but this is bass and treble, and he brought some mid-range.
Just the two of us. That's
the song that comes to mind, but then I think of the Beatles song.
On our way home, you and me have memories. This week we're going to talk about one of the classic albums of the 80s, the Talking Heads' Remain in Light.
And then later on we're going to talk about what happened this week in music history and talk about the sucky song of the day, which is always here to disappoint you.
And if you haven't already subscribed, go ahead and check us out on iTunes and SoundCloud, new SoundCloud, or on our website, bassandtreblepodcast.com. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome. You can always find us on Facebook. Just look for Bass and Treble, and Twitter, as always, for our usual content updates.
Sweet.
So, let's dive right into the album review. This album is your pick, and, out of all the albums in the world, you chose Talking Heads. It's something that, if I could be 100% honest, I've never listened to all the way through before this week.
That makes two of us.
Okay. All of a sudden, we're experts.
Yeah, we're stepping out of our comfort zone.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're trying to diversify a little bit and go into a decade that really is not that well known for its, I guess it is well known, but is a little bit overshadowed by the decade before it.
And the decade after it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. When you think about 80s rock, you think about hair bands and glam bands and and even punk rock, and there's a bunch of different subgenres in the 80s of rock, but I think that this falls into many of those different categories, actually.
Damn right. I think people were shaking off the 70s back then. It's a good thing that they moved in some new tracks, but I'll just go ahead and go over the album itself, if I may.
You may.
The album is called Remain in Light. It's by The Talking Heads, which is another The band. It's not Talking Heads. It's
The Talking Heads.
And that consists of David Byrne, lead vocals, guitar, and overall weirdo. Chris France, drummer. Tina Weymouth.
Not Tina Fey.
Wow, that's a rough name when you're a woman. Weymouth. Okay. And Jerry Harrison. Tina Weymouth plays the bass, so that's cool. And Jerry Harrison, which played keyboards and guitar. Not a usual setup for a band, I'd say. All the different multi-instrumentalists. But I like it. And it was released the 8th of October in 1980.
Yeah, the only one that really matters is David Byrne. He's kind of a superstar, and he's still kind of relevant today. And these other people, can you name anything that they've done? Have you, even in the videos, you look at their video, and it's all David Byrne. It's the David Byrne show. All David Byrne, all the time.
He's a front man, but when you listen to the album, there's definitely those other guys that are overlooked are an integral part of their sound, I would say.
Yeah, but I mean, we'll get into this when we start breaking down the tracks, but there's so much music going on in these songs, it's really hard to break it down into a drummer, a bass, keyboard, and guitar. There's a whole lot more to it than that. I don't know why these guys get the special credit for, you know, being part of the core of the band when I'm sure you have a bunch of extra guys in there as well.
Right, definitely. And it looks like they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So that's a good one, right?
That's right, yeah. So if you're the one that picked this album this week, tell us why. I mean, if this is an album that you're not so familiar with, and an album that you just wanted to pick up out of nowhere, you got a big selection of choices out there. Why'd you go with this one?
Well, I thought we needed to dive into the 80s. I think I alluded to that a little bit. And I picked an album from one of my favorite 80s bands with one of those songs that gets stuck in your head once in a lifetime, and that so happens to be Talking Heads. And Once in a Lifetime is a real favorite song of mine. And I'd never heard the entire album before, but after checking it out, I understood why Rolling Stone named it third best album of the 80s.
Because everything else sucked.
There is that. I mean, they were slammed right between, I think, Paul Simon and Thriller or something like that. Like, it was, they were right there.
Those are two amazing albums. This one, I gotta admit, after I listened to it, I was not such a big fan on a bunch of different levels.
Okay, well, we can agree to disagree on the one fact that I thought they were ahead of their time because they mix so many sounds. I mean, I hear Prince, I hear Stevie Wonder, I hear Parliament Funkadelic, I hear disco, I hear jazz, I hear so many sounds. It's a eclectic band.
So then how could you say that they're ahead of their time when everything you just mentioned was late 70s and early 80s? It sounds to me like they are right on track. If this album was released in 1980, it has just enough of that disco funk, it has just enough of that 70s sound, but it's also a good intro into that 80s electronica, or electronic style music. So have to say,
David Byrne.
I can call him a visionary. I can call him, you know, not your typical musician or you know, very eclectic out there kind of guy, but as far as being ahead of his time, I think this album was perfectly placed in 1980.
Well, you know what they say about hindsight. I think it's really early in the 80s. I think everything, you got to think about this is like October 1980, and in, you know, later on in the 80s, everything tries to kind of go on this path. And as we go track by track, I think we can kind of cover all of our bases, why everything that was added there wasn't normally used, wasn't a normal occurrence. And then after they did it in this album, it became more widely popularized and used, but just not to the same effect, I think, as Talking Heads. If I could hit it on the head, they're like a serious musical group that it doesn't take themselves seriously in a decade when everybody was corny and cheesy as hell. I think they just somehow were able to be a legitimate musical group and push that boundary without being dismissed like other bands of the 80s that were kind of dismissed as just being 80s bands. Like, no one knows who they, like, no one can think about them today like they can the Talking Heads.
You're right. As eclectic and diverse and just downright strange as this album is, it's amazing that it remains so popular and that it was named one of the best albums of the 80s. It's really out there, but somehow it has enough appeal to it where it maintained.
Yeah, definitely.
It's just moving along to discuss some of the album's themes.
Does this album have a theme? Because I think most of the themes could be put into a PSA on don't do drugs, kids.
Yeah, I started paying attention to a lot of the lyrics as I was going through this, and it's strangely political.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is.
There's a few songs on there which touch on very touchy subjects. I don't know how to describe it.
No, because it does bounce around, but I think a lot of the themes are political, maybe is a little bit of it, but I think a lot of it is just societal. A lot of the themes of like what really gets the gears turning either in your life or in society or in a political sense. I think a lot of it, they were kind of interesting lyrics and had deep thought to it. I think the thing is, David Byrne's delivery makes it so incredibly difficult for you to take it seriously. It's just entertaining. And it's broken up. Like it's like he's not even concerned if it rhymes or if it just is on beat. Like he just somehow freestyles a lot of these lyrics, and it's amazing to listen to.
It has a very stream of consciousness kind of feel to it, and I think it's David Byrne's style to not always sing all the time. He mixes a lot of speaking with his singing to the point where you can't even tell if he's trying to sing.
Right.
Or if it's just the inflection in his voice as he's saying it out loud. It's really a fine line when he's going through a lot of these songs. And you can hear it, you know, on the most famous track, Once in a Lifetime. But even on other songs, I think it's just David Byrne's style to just kind of throw words out there and see what sticks.
Absolutely.
A lot of it's kind of irrational and just kind of flows with the wind.
I think that's a great way to put it. So let me introduce a brand new section to us. So what is the first rock fact for today?
Well, did you know that David Byrne once fed an entire flock of seagulls for over a year using nothing but renewable energy and used Keurig cups?
No, I didn't, but it doesn't surprise me in the least. Did you know, Steve, that the name Talking Heads came from the ancient days of feudal France when the guillotine was invented? Sometimes the chopped off heads would attempt to talk, but without breath in their lungs, they just rolled on.
Like a Rolling Stone. The album title, Remain in Light, was a reference to divers on deep sea excavations. It would get so dark in those murky depths that the divers had to keep in contact so they would tell each other, remain in light.
That's pretty deep, and that wraps up our... Sweet. So now let's just jump into the track listing. Actually, let me just start off by saying all of the tracks, or not all the tracks, but other than Once in a Lifetime, did you notice that none of the track names are actually seem to be said in the actual tracks? Or if they are, I couldn't hear them.
It's really hard to make out anything David Byrne says, first of all.
Right.
The Heat Goes On is the first track on here. And yeah, that's what the chorus is. The heat goes on, and the heat goes on, and the heat goes on, and the heat goes on.
That's in the parentheses. That's correct. And wow, that's a fail right there. But I think it's a very funky song, especially that heat goes on. It's like a mantra, right? I mean...
Yes, I can agree with
that. It's just quirky. Reminds me of Roxy Music a lot, which Brian Eno produced this album. He was a synth player and co-founder of Roxy Music in their heyday.
So it would only make sense that, yeah, he would be a big influence on this album as well. And I think this song starts out the whole album, and it sets the tone for the album. It really kind of lets you know what the Talking Heads are all about.
It's a fast beat. Fast beat, quick, upbeat, right?
Yeah, it starts with a punch.
Yeah, totally throws you into it. I just want to say this. I think David Byrne is the reinvention of Brian Ferry, just less of a douche. And I think this song kind of throws you into this, what are these guys on? What am I going to listen to? I think if you were to have bought this album and put this on as the first track, you would have been a little bit intrigued, to say the least, with just the amount of punch
to say the
it
least.
Starts off with.
Yeah, I think I heard some animal sounds in there. I couldn't tell if it was a monkey or a bird, or maybe some kind of Dr. Moreau
hybrid.
There's
all kinds of monkey
boat.
Bird sounds going on throughout. And there's even an arcade sound solo in the song. Towards the middle, you just hear like all these cool things. And I was thinking 1980, Super Mario didn't come out for a couple more years, right? Super Mario was 82 or 84. If I can remember correctly.
Yeah, these are the early days of arcade games.
So it was legit arcade sounds being mixed in there. And toward the end, I will say it gets kind of repetitive, but I forgive them. Like, they just got carried away with the jam and they couldn't stop.
Track after this is called Cross-Eyed and Painless.
Which the hell does that even
this
mean?
This might be like what you're talking about. I don't even know how they would fit those into the lyrics.
I don't know either. But it's just like continuation of track one. It's just the funk is still rolling. The drummer's doing like these crazy like African rhythms. And the only reason I know that is because I watched a documentary on Ginger Baker and from Cream, and he was big on that stuff. And It's wild. I mean, it's just constant, and the bass is like subtle. It's just a really funky kind of second track to follow up the first track with, and really kind of sets us up nicely as you're listening to it.
I really like the beat in this song. It's a good beat to drive to. It just feels like if you got to get going somewhere, this is the kind of song you'd want to have on. I guess it could be a good song, but if there's one thing you know about me and my music taste, is that I can't stand falsetto. And he just hits a few notes in here that just drive me nuts. So, yeah, as far as this track goes, I'm going to give it a big thumbs down.
Gotcha.
But that's all right, because after that, we move into The Great Curve. It's a third track on the album, and this picks it up. This makes up for Cross-Eyed and Painless before it.
So you didn't like the second track so much, and then The Great Curve comes in, and you like it?
Yeah, this more than makes up for that last song. Great Curve has a super fast beat, and it's the kind of beat that makes me want to move. I want to like jump up out of my chair and start dancing.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a little bit of African rhythms mixed in with a disco bass. Well, it works.
Disco bass.
It is. It's a disco bass. It's very disco. and the guitar solo is totally 80s. It has that like shrilly kill me now kind of sound. I don't even know what they're singing, but I love that there's like a back and forth call and answer thing going on between the band.
Actually, they're singing about the world. They bring it up a lot in this song. It makes sense because it kind of feels like world music.
Totally.
And I kind of have a feeling, I mean, this is just my own two cents here, but he's kind of singing about Mother Earth in a way, as the world. You know, she is moving to describe the world. She has messages for everyone. She's moving by remote control. Hands that move her are invisible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she loves the world and all the people in it. She shakes them up when she starts to walk.
The hands that move her are invisible. That almost has a kind of a God vibe to it, too. That's interesting.
Or it kind of goes along with this theme where, you know, the hands of the government are constantly invisible and moving things around.
Totally, so. Totally get it. And the only way you would know what he's saying is if you look up the lyrics, because, man, there's just... I thought that it was a song about like a actual woman for a while, because he kept talking about like she. I'm like, okay, so he's talking about the Great Curve. I'm thinking that has some kind of sexual connotation to it. But thanks for educating us, Steve. There's a deeper message.
I am only one man.
One man, two ears, one mouth, two testicles.
I got it all, man.
You got it all, dude. Living it up. And so track four is Once in a Lifetime, which is timeless. Great song.
We hit the groove in this album. It's finally time to blast you with the hit song.
It's got this repeating synth melody thing going on. I didn't count how many notes it were, but it has this really awesome delay effect. It's like... It almost reminds me a little bit of On the Run from Darkside, but just a little bit more of a delayed effect to it.
I like that.
Which is really kind of a cool thing to have, a little droning synth in the background, right?
Yeah, and it wasn't until I started listening to this album with more of a critical ear, it's like, all right, how am I going to talk about this? And it struck me like this song is almost like a sermon. Like, you go to like a Pentecostal church, and you hear this song, and he's almost like preaching.
Yeah.
Like, the way he's delivering these lines, I really kind of like it.
And it's got those kind of like kind of neat drum claps, and I love how the bass line sneaks in just a little bit. You know, it's like... Like it's
really simple.
Super simple.
But it just fits the song so well.
And the lyrics, they make sense and at the same time are nonsense. They're just so wild and free. I think there's a meaning behind everything he's saying, but it's the way he delivers it that sucks me in. Of all the songs on this album, it's the most rockish. It's the most like just a like rock song. Maybe the only rock song, I think, on this whole album that's just, like, got that rock and roll feel.
It's the least eclectic out of all of them. But it finally clicked. I think I figured out what the song is about.
It's about success. It's about living for things other than yourself.
What if I told you it's about a midlife crisis?
That makes complete total sense. The character in it could be... Right, yeah, this is not my beautiful house. It's just not my beautiful wife.
Right.
It's
you like, may find yourself living in a shotgun shack or another part of the world. It's like at this point, you're a grown up.
What's a shotgun shack again? Is that a... Do you know what that is?
It's probably where it gets its name. A shotgun house is just a small domestic residence, no more than 12 feet wide. It was real popular towards the end of the Civil War. Just a very small house, basically. Just a like a little shotgun shack.
So he's talking about... You could be in a small situation or a big situation. You could be...
Behind the wheel of a large automobile. In a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you'd be like, how did I get here?
My favorite part is to be when he says, there is water at the bottom of the ocean. As he says it, like it's such a statement. And you're like, okay, I know there is. But it definitely, it's like a deep way to say something that you already know. Because, you know, it makes you think, like, is there water at the bottom of the ocean?
Not only that, but think about the water pressure at the bottom of the ocean.
It's It's a lot of, so there, the midlife crisis comes in again.
If we're going on with this whole midlife crisis thing, yeah, he's underwater. He's under pressure.
And then he starts saying water, and it gets all weird. Like, water, 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 water. what's going on? Hey, maybe he's talking about being underwater, like being upside down on your mortgage, being in debt.
Being under a lot of pressure.
Pressure. Yeah, that's cool. It's a cool way of looking at it, Steve.
Same as it ever was.
Same as it ever was. Yeah, it's a hell of a groove, and every time I have a jukebox near me, like at a bar, this is like one of my go-to tracks that I put on because it undoubtedly gets everybody in a good mood.
Keep that in mind when we go to the sucky song of the day.
Okay,
just hold on to that. When you're talking about bar songs,
I live in a state where Journey spontaneously gets sung in a cappella at bars.
Hold on to that. We're gonna dive deep into that in just a little while.
Awesome, awesome.
But for now, let's keep on moving through the album. After Once in a Lifetime, the fifth track on the album is called Houses in Motion. So what do you think about this song, Neil?
It's got these little poppy keyboard things in it. I said that it sounded like Stevie Wonder. It's very like, it's got, what's that Stevie Wonder song, Higher Ground?
Or Higher Ground, okay.
Higher Ground. It's got kind of this little like Higher Ground keyboard thing going on, and it's just... it's back to funky. Like, it's just such a funky song.
Not just funky, I would call it super funk. This is the funkiest song in the album.
Yeah, definitely.
It kind of reminded me of Toe Jam and Earl. I don't know if you ever played that game, but the soundtrack sounds like it was lifted directly out of this song.
I remember.
That groovy, funky, straight down to that crazy, trippy trumpet solo.
Yeah, I was listening to that, and I know that we had talked about a little bit before the podcast. You said trumpet solo. I think it's a trombone setting on a synth, because it turns into this, like, Middle Eastern scale. I'm like, what the hell? Like, that can't be an actual horn instrument. But maybe it is. Roxy, this is why I think Brian Eno Roxy Music. Roxy Music was known to have a big brass section, especially live. And I'm thinking, man, they probably gave one of the trombone players like a bunch of sunshine acid and were like, here, play the highest notes you can on your instrument.
And they made it happen.
Yeah, it's nuts. I could go on and on about the musicality of the song, but I won't. Like, it is such a musician song. It is so badass. She has closed her eyes. She has given up hope. I'm not gonna lie.
Well, that is where the album ends for me. I'm with it. I like what I hear. It's eclectic. It's out there.
Except for track two.
If you want to get specific, yes, we could break it down. But once we get into the track Seen and Not Seen, the sixth track, this album takes a very big turn. Things start getting really weird around here. It's not the same album. It's like, you can tell if it was a vinyl record, time to flip the record, because side B is not the same as side A.
Well, the thing is that this record, I looked that up because I thought you might mention it. This record, the first three tracks were side A. Side B starts with Once in a Lifetime all the way through to the last track.
Surprising. Okay.
I think back in the day, and I did a little research on this, back in the day, the reason they did that is because they always wanted to have what they thought was a hit song be the first song of side B. They would always work it out that way. Because that way, if someone was listening to side A, logically, they didn't like the first song. They're like, let me flip this and give it one more try. The hope is that that first song on side B would take their breath away.
There was a method to their madness there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this song gets really creepy with the lyrics. Almost like a descent into madness kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, he's looking around and he's looking at all these faces, and over time, the faces get kind of stuck in his head, in the back of his mind.
And it turns into spoken word in several parts of it. I still like the song. I think his lyrics are creepy. I like to picture David Byrne as a person who hides when he hears that loud noise in his house and goes, oh, what was that? And this song really sells his fear voice. I think, like, he likes just kind of twitching and acting like there's something hiding around the corner. In fact, if he had a whole slew of songs that were just based in this kind of key and tone, you could probably say he could have been a hell of a goth singer.
I could agree with that.
Yeah, so I don't know. I like the song, but then again, I like when things are start to, like, the when the music doesn't totally line up with it, and when you're saying creepy, there's these weird, like, synth breaks in there that are just like, like squeaky doors, and like, I think the synth player just had, like, free reign in this song. Do whatever you want.
And he makes it all happen in just under 3.5 minutes. This is the shortest track on the album. It's just like, let me just tell this super creepy story and get the hell out of here. I'm done.
Yeah.
We have more creepy stuff to move on to.
Right, like The Listening Wind. Tell us about The Listening Wind, because you unearthed what this song was truly about, and I gotta admit, I was a little disturbed by it. I'm like, whoa, this what? Who is he writing about this for?
Yeah, it's a story of a terrorist, basically. And again, it kind of cements this transition from funky into spooky. It tells the story of this guy, Mojik, who carries out a bombing of American colonialists. And it goes into detail about, you know, his plans and how he carries it out. You know, it's one of those tracks that happens on the album, but even at some point, David Byrne decided to stop playing this song live because it's sensitive. It's pretty obvious why it's better to be kept on an album, but you don't need to bring it up again.
Yeah, I like the guitar on this. It reminds me of David Gilmour a little bit. There's a lot of cool little spacey guitar solo licks in there. The chorus to me is amazing. When he's the lyrics in there talking about the wind in my heart, the dust in my hair, the wind in my heart comes to drive them away. I mean, there's like a real. It's not something where he's telling a story from the. How can I put this? From the oppressor, which might have been the colonialist in this view, it's from the oppressed point of view, which makes it even more controversial because it's kind of painting him in not so negative light, like he's going to carry this out.
It gives you right, that's exactly it. It's the view of a terrorist from the terrorist's point of view.
You know what's crazy? Before 9/11, totally going off track real quick, before 9/11, there used to be on TV when I was growing up in the 90s, they used to have these movies on that were about, I forget the airline, but the airline hijackings of the 80s.
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of movies that came out. There was like two or three movies that came out that were about that. They were specifically about like what happened inside the plane and like, you know, how it all went down. And after 9/11, they stopped playing those movies. Like it became like not like you don't want to put that on TV. People are going to be really sensitive to it. And then they had like the flight, whatever, 314 or whatever that movie was on the one flight that ended up in the middle of like a field somewhere right off in Virginia.
Right.
The one that was supposed to go to the White House.
Yep.
I'll say this. It's definitely a sensitive subject, but it's one that the more we try to not understand it, the more it kind of shields us from the truth. I'm not saying in any way I defend the actions. What I'm saying is there's an overarching story from the point of view of the person who sees themselves as the oppressed that we want to snuff out because now it's personal. It happened to my generation, my generation probably was the most impacted from it. If all generations were impacted, but my generation growing up, I was 16 when it happened or whatever, 15 or 16. It's a hell of a thing to make a song that's from the terrorist point of view. I find it to be very spooky and very eerie. Yeah, just a really, really eerie song. I don't think anybody could get away with writing a song like that today. And I totally understand why he doesn't sing it live. People probably be like, "The hell is he singing about?"
Yep, it gets detailed. And then we wrap up with a song called The Overload. It's the eighth track on the album. Yeah, it's not the longest album in the world. It's just eight tracks. You get it and quit it.
And yeah, that's right.
This could be the bleakest song on the album. It just keeps on descending into this spooky, creepy, bleak side. What's funny, there's a story behind this track where the Talking Heads were trying to make a song that sounded like Joy Division, only they had never heard Joy Division's music. They had read about them, and they had read reviews, and they wrote this song based entirely on descriptions in the music press. And believe it or not, they actually came out pretty close. I'd say they hit it spot on.
Yeah.
This song is just somber and bleak.
Yeah. It's like, it's not the longest track on the album, but it feels like it, because it's slowing down, and it's just really spaced out. It's got so many different, like, sound effects and random, like, pops and whistles and things in it. And I just wanted to note that it's called Overload, which made me think of Overture, which is kind of an extended piece of music. A lot of times Overture take a theme and just stretch it out. I mean, it can't be an Overture because it's not the introduction to the album, but I think it's, I don't know. To me, I like it when an album kind of winds down. It's like the opposite of what the Gorillaz album did for me, which is ended on this super high-paced track and then boom, cut it out. And I'm like, whoa, wait a second. It's not the best song. It's probably my least favorite song of all of them. Yeah, but
I see what you're saying too. It's like the song, the album starts out so powerful and fun and funky and energetic, and then it just keeps slipping away into this slow, depressing, somber stuff. And by the end of the album, I just want one more hit of that funky stuff to balance me out, just to bring me back up. Like it leaves you on a very slow and somber note, and I'm not a big fan of that.
Right, and I'm pretty sure a lot of people left this side on the album or on the track or maybe even on the tape side and hit rewind and listened to Once in a Lifetime again and let it play all the way through and did that a few times. You're just like all the way through.
That's all you need.
I don't know, Listening Wind is a really cool song. I even though it's a really crappy subject or whatever, I thought it was a cool song. It's the way it's delivered. I like his singing in it. So Steve, yay or nay, what's your verdict on this album?
It's a tough call, because like I've been saying all along, it almost feels like two albums. But overall, I'm going to give it a single yay. A single yay was given on this day. It's twisted enough to be seriously groundbreaking for 1980. It came in just at the right time, in my opinion. It's funky enough to stand out from anything else at the time, but also so twisted that it doesn't really have mainstream appeal. I mean, maybe nothing David Byrne ever did was mainstream. But I keep going back to that second half of the album. It sways me almost towards a nay. In the end, it just kind of makes me feel desolate and alone, and that's not how I like music to make me feel. Right. So, overall, I'll give it a single yay, but it's somewhat grudgingly.
So it's not a double yay, it's just a single yay.
Just a single yay was given.
From now on, all album ratings have to be either single yay, double yay, or single nay or double nay. And we'll let people figure out what it means.
All right, so let me throw the ball back in your court. What's your verdict on the album as a whole?
I give it a yay. I loved it. I say go stream this album ASAP. You're not going to regret it. Definitely, and I'm putting this from a perspective that I didn't look too deep into the lyrics, because I knew that there's some really depressing shit in there. I didn't want to be like focused too much on it, but I think there's just feats of fancy left and right, and it's nothing short of what I would call a modern art masterpiece, in the sense that it's totally off the wall music. It's not going to make you think, oh, that reminds me of, no, it's not. You're just going to be like, oh, that was new. I think in 2015, we could all use a little new sound. And this is, to me is really kind of a, unique, album.
Okay.
Kind of happy I picked it.
Would you give it a yay or a double yay?
Oh, you're going to make me choose the yay or double yay. Can I give it a hey?
No. All right.
No, I'll go ahead and give it a. I'll also give it a single yay. I don't think it deserves double yay designation.
All right, fair enough.
So, Steve, why don't we go over some of the hits in the song? And I think there's really only one hit in this song, which is to nobody's surprise. What song is that, Steve?
Is it The Great Curve?
I thought it was Seen and Not Seen.
No, it's Once in a Lifetime. It's the song that everyone
knows. It is Once in a Lifetime. And it also sounds like a shitty soap opera, right? Once in a Lifetime. Today on Once in a Lifetime.
Yep.
Yeah, it's such a good song. It really is. I think it holds well to this day.
Is it also the only video from this album?
I believe so. I believe it's the only video from this album, but it was, I mean, it was like, this is pre-MTV, right? 1980?
Yeah, MTV was 1984. I think it was also pre-green screen, because if you look at some of those effects in there, they were really pushing the limits of that technology at the time.
So when you talk about green screen, Steve, let's talk more about David Byrne's, whatever the scarecrow type of move thing he does. Man, that guy is
crazy. I thought you were almost going to call it dancing, but you know it's not.
We went over this. Yeah, it's not a dance when there's twitching. No actual rhythm. It's weird. The video, he's like sweating profusely. Hands come out of the edges. It's such a... For it being cheesy effects and everything, I'll give it credit that he was Urkel before Urkel, and he was like dressed like Buddy Holly in a weird suit. Like, I don't know, it was Pee-wee Herman-ish. I don't know what to think. Was this pre-Pee-wee Herman?
This was pre-everything that we know and love.
So, in similar artists and albums, is it fair to say that they're kind of 80s pioneers, that this being October 8th, 1980... The 80s have officially started with this album and the Talking Head. This isn't their first album, by the way. I think it's their third or fourth effort, but this is like a pioneer. Would you say stylistically and musically they're kind of there, or is it more just stylistically?
Yeah, they opened the door to the 80s, in my opinion. At this point, you know, disco was fading out. It still has some remnants of disco in its funk tracks, but its use of electronic music and synth, I think, opened the door to a lot of 80s music. I think the 80s wouldn't have been the same without this. And I understand why some might say it's legendary, but it's legendary in a certain way, in a very specific way. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about similar artists and albums, I think a lot of the 80s owes some credit to David Byrne.
Yeah, definitely. And then you had put down Joy Division, which I've listened to some Joy Division. There's some slower Joy Division. There's also some heavier Joy Division. I think Joy Division
I was leaning more towards the slower. The slow and somber, melancholy, and spooky tracks towards the end remind me a lot more of Joy Division.
Didn't later Joy Division inspire Kurt Cobain to some point?
I could see that.
Yeah, awesome. I'm right there with you. I put down Roxy Music, which is a 70s band.
But it's also got that Brian Eno reference.
Yeah, Brian Eno was in it, and they broke up the band, him and Brian Ferry, or I think he continued without Brian Eno, but Brian Eno was like the heart and soul of that band. Roxy Music is best known for its song Love is a Drug, which is a personal favorite of mine. For whatever reason, it was glam rock, but I liked it. All right,
so that's our take on Remain in Light by the Talking Heads. Excellent album, but not a double yay.
It's a single yay. I love this. We should just do single yay and double yay to describe everyday things in life.
I'm going to start doing
that. If you have
a
good day at work, I'll be like, Steve, how's your day going? Single yay. Really? Man, I'm a double yay right now. My yay is turning into a nay.
My day started as a nay, and now it's a yay.
Yay. So this week in music history, I'm going to go over the first thing that happened this week in music history back in 1955. The Chrysler Corporation launched high-fidelity record players for their 1956 lineup of cars. The unit measured about 4 inches high. I'm assuming you're saying that this is like the record-playing unit. Measured about 4 inches high, so let's picture this, people. 4 inches high and less than a foot wide, so like a 4x10 hole thing. And mounted under the instrument panel. 7-inch disc spun at 16 and 2/3 RPM. Wait, hold on. Time out. I understand that the grooves were deeper and all that, but how that, like, I've heard of ESP disc players in the 90s. How the fuck did you not ruin every goddamn record when you combine a 1956 car suspension with a fucking needle in a record player?
That's exactly like my point. That's why I threw this up here, because it doesn't make any sense at all. It was only discontinued 6 years later.
And it lasted 5 years?
Yeah, six years.
So wait, 5 full car manufacturing years, they didn't get enough complaints of like, I can't play a record on this shit. And they're like, no, just put it on. That's like typical car salesman. I bet you like they talked about it all the time. And people were like, yeah, well, my buddy Tom, you know, well, back then how they talked, like, yeah, now, see, I was going to the ball game. My buddy Tom, we couldn't play Zigzag Wiggle Wham by the new Ball J Boys. And it's like, oh, that's his model. I mean, all songs back then were Batman action sounds, you know? Bam, pow, wham, a pow. Like, it's on the radio. Pow, pow, wham, pow. Pow, pow, wham, pow, pow. All the songs were like that, you know?
And now you can carry those songs with you in the car.
Yeah, the most convenient way possible on a fucking 7-inch record that you have to...
It played at 16 RPM.
It's so weird.
No, it was a bad idea from the start.
Yeah, it's very odd.
So then, 40 years after that happened, we're going to jump ahead to the Smashing Pumpkins came out with Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. I know you've been digging on that album a little bit lately, Neil.
Yeah.
It's a double album. It's
the end of alternative, the end of grunge, right? Or the end of alternative rock was that album.
Yeah, you're right. This week in 1995, we laid grunge to rest.
Yep, we had Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness of not having another good Smashing Pumpkins record. Right? Like, that was the last good Smashing Pumpkins record? I don't even think that was that good compared to, like, you know, Pisces Iscariot, Siamese Dream.
I think it's a great album, but it's one of those albums that had to grow on me. Mm-hmm. Like, when I first got it, I was totally disappointed. I was expecting all killer, no filler. And there's a piano solo in there. The title track is a piano solo. And it had a good mix of alternative and mellow stuff. But that's when I realized things are changing.
The times, they are changing. And then jumping up 11 years to 2006, CBGB, the legendary New York punk club, which, hey, that banner is at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Steve. You and I saw it in person. Remember that?
I do.
It was awesome. It was credited with discovering Patti Smith. Here's Patti Smith again. And the Ramones. Closed after a final gig by Smith herself, Blondie and Talking Heads also found fame after performing at the club, which helped launch U.S. punk music. The venue first opened in December 1973. Its full name, CBGB OMFUG, standing for Country, Bluegrass, Blues, and Other Music for Uplifting Gormandizers.
Yeah, I bet you don't know what a gormandizer is, do you?
What's the etymology of that word?
A gormandizer? No results for gormandizers.
Some made-up shit. Is it German? It's got an accent over the A when you pulled it, wherever resource you pulled it from.
No, a gormandizer is usually a ravenous eater of food. But according to unconfirmed sources, it means a voracious eater of music.
That's just, like, that's the only time that word has ever been used in the popular thing, and I'm pretty sure that people just thought, yeah, we're going to CBGB, and it's like, oh yeah, man, I can't see, look for the sign that says Umfug. Umfug. Got it. Umfug. I'm there.
Actually, I did see CBGBs when I first moved here to New York. It was about 3 months before CBGBs closed down, and I spent a lot of that summer just walking the streets, getting familiar with New York City.
Walking the streets, finding out all the best corners to do smack and slam on bitches.
But yeah, I will never forget the moment where I turned the corner and see CBGB's right in front of me. I had no idea I was coming up on it. And I'm like, wow, I've seen that name, I've seen that banner, so many different places. Mm-hmm. And just a few short months after moving here, peace out. Legendary location gone.
You came, it left. That's sometimes the way it happens.
Yep. Most recently, in 2008, this is something that you guys might remember, Ringo Starr pulled a 180 and he's like, you know what, guys, I'm too busy. I no longer have time to sign autographs. And he asked fans not to send him any mail at all. No more fan mail, no objects to be signed, nothing. He wrapped up a tour between the U.S. and Canada, and he was spending his time between his homes in Los Angeles, the south of France, and Surrey back in the U.K.
Wait a second. Are you becoming an apologist for Ringo Starr not being willing to sign some autograph mail just to send a little? Doesn't he have like secretaries to do this shit for him to just rubber stamp this stuff? Like where he doesn't have to physically look at them all. I mean,
you would think so.
His secretary was lazy.
But could you imagine 40 years of being hounded by your fans everywhere you go?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of pay your bills in a way. I'm just saying, man.
Like Ringo Starr needs more money to pay his bills.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. Shit, he gave it a long run. And here's a little bit of music history this week. That's not really music history, Steve. It's more gum history. Are you ready for this?
I don't know. I don't know if I'm ever ready for gum history.
This is directly from NBC News, a reputable news source, unless it's Brian Williams. Apparently, a piece of Seattle history is coming down, or rather, a million little pieces.
Oh, the gum wall.
Crews are cleaning up the city's famous gum wall near Pike Place Market, where tourists and locals have been sticking their used chewing gum for the past 20 years. Can we collectively say,
ew.
That is gross. but I still think it's so stupid that they're cleaning it. Like people get sanctioned to put graffiti up on walls, right? This is fucking America. And if that wall has 20 years worth of gum on it, then by God, it deserves to have 20 years worth of gum on it.
There's a reason why no one has cleaned it in the past 20 years.
Exactly. And then the people that did it, of course, because you know how liberals are. We do some shit and then we're like, oh, we'll justify it by saying, we don't expect it to stay clean for long. Like, douchebag, it's 20 years worth of gum. Like, it's, you're not gonna fucking, like, unless you get, like, every Major League Baseball player to take a fucking week off and generate chewing gum in all those different colors, you're never gonna get the effect of the barnacle gum wall that you had going on. Like, it was probably inches sticking out from its original placement because of that gum. It just depresses me that we had to do that. Like, why? Just why?
It's sad.
It is. It's sad. And what the little musical tie to all this is that it's the reason why they say it has so much gum is that there's an entrance to a theater. People stand in line waiting to get into that theater. And over the years, they've been sticking their gum to the wall and it became tradition.
It's a colorful wall.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
They got every color gum up there.
So, Steve, what's our sucky song of the day?
Are you ready for this?
I'm not holding back. I haven't even seen it. I don't even know what it is. I'm just seeing it now. Oh God, Steve.
Oh, God. Yep, you got it right.
This is so bad.
This is Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer.
Does anybody defend this song anymore as being a good song?
Yeah. Lately, a lot of these sucky songs of the day have been a bit controversial. I understand that. A lot of these songs that we choose were very popular at one point.
Well, last week's was, because somehow that's a really popular song, Ace of Base's The Sign.
And Living on a Prayer was one of the quintessential songs of the 80s. But let's break it down. Let me explain what makes this song so sucky. It's cliche. It starts out with a little, you know, little guitar intro, and Bon Jovi over the music, he's like, once upon a time, not too long ago. It's like, all right, are you setting us up for like a fairy tale? Because this is a really shitty fairy tale if it is. And then like, he just says a lot of stuff. He's like, we gotta hold on to what we've got.
Does it really matter if we make it or not?
Like, even the title, Living on a Prayer, the whole thing just seems trite. It goes beyond cliche to trite. I mean, if there was one line that I really like, it's just the way that he presents the line. He's like, you live for the fight when that's all that you've got. But even that's freaking cliche as hell. Like, I love the way he delivers it, but what he's saying is just stupid.
Can we just, as a society, come together as one and demand that Bon Jovi not come up with any more fucking terrible cliche songs? I mean, I know we're going to focus on Living on the Prayer in a second, but let's talk about this for a second.
Okay.
Living on a Prayer, dead or alive.
Right.
Fucking up there. And then It's My Life was like the comeback shitstorm of the year.
Right.
Like, this is what brings you back is this horrible, shitty song about it being your life. I mean, the only comparison I take to this is going to be really controversial, is when Rob Thomas and Santana decided to make an album together and made a whole collection of cliche music.
Right.
Like, it's just Yeah, you're right. There's just so many cliche songs that, oh, Living on a Prayer.
You can't forget another one of his famous songs. I think it was from the same album. It's Your Love is Like Bad Medicine.
Yeah.
Come on.
It's so bad. And then what's the theme of the song, right? So you're living on a prayer, so it's...
The theme of the song is sexism. it's stereotypical men and women roles. Tommy, it tells the story of Tommy and Gina.
Wait, what is it? Is Tommy and Gina the ones who never back down?
Are you thinking of Jack and Diane?
No, that's what I was thinking of for the beginning, but I'm thinking of... So wait a second, hold on. For Tommy and Gina who never back down? That's from It's My Life. He somehow reused Tommy and Gina from Living on a Prayer and It's My Life, and I just realized it. So not only is it cliche, he relived the fucking cliche in another shitty song.
Let me break down into their sexist stereotypes, okay? Tommy was a union worker, right? Tommy worked on the docks. Yeah, like all good men do.
Blue-blooded Americans that don't let you do anything on your own.
Tommy was a guitar player. He had his sixth string in hock. He was down on his luck. Now, Gina, on the other hand, had a waitress job. I don't know if there's anything more stereotypically female than, you know, working for the man, bringing home her pay for his love.
By flirting really? With other men, potentially, or being objectified by other men, serving them food.
So, I mean, yeah, all this cliche crap makes this song so sucky. But I think the cherry on top of this suck Sunday is how often you hear this on karaoke night. You had made a reference to Journey earlier, and, you know, sometimes when you go to a bar, you like to pop some quarters or $5 bills in the jukebox. And you get to hear some songs sometimes. But I propose, I'm making this public, I propose a 1-year moratorium on Don't Stop Believing and Living on a Prayer.
Wait, does this happen in New York City? Do you ever hear that song when you're out?
All the time. I go to karaoke.
People think it's fun.
People know it. It's a crowd pleaser. But it's not.
It's not. It's a gag song at this point. It's like a gift you give somebody at Spencer's when they're turning 50. It doesn't hold any water.
Yeah, I'm not completely against abolishing this song forever, but I'm just saying, if we as a society were to spend 1 year putting this song on hold, don't play it in bars, don't play it on karaoke night, don't play it anywhere for 1 year, I think we can then bring it back in a more controlled, not annoying fashion, and it would be maybe a decent song. But the fact that it's so overplayed adds to its suckiness.
It sure does.
In fact, I can't even hear this. I can't even play this song in my head without hearing drunken people slur it in a bar.
Like bottles clinging and like people getting kicked out of the back door.
When I hear this song in my head, it's not the Bon Jovi version. It's the drunken karaoke version.
Steve, as you may know, may or may not know, I lived most of my life in South Florida. And sometimes in South Florida, I would be in what's called Hollywood Beach. Now, Hollywood Beach is known for a few things. A few things it's known for is people that relate to Tommy.
Late night bars.
A lot of guys that are Tommy. Literally named Tommy, union working, and that can't play guitar with a shit. And then a lot of Ginas. And somehow, Tommy's and Ginas managed to live well into their fucking way past their prime 50s and 60s. And most of those people think this song is a good song.
This song speaks to them.
Right. It speaks to them because they lived out the cliche. The other thing I'll say is now that I'm in Ohio, there's a few things I've seen at a bar. One thing I've seen is I've seen actual physical altercations over a baseball game. Never seen that before in my life in Florida. And I've seen spontaneous a cappella Journey more than once.
I would like to think that as a society, as a human race, we're past that.
Do you think Journey's a good band?
You got to prepare me for questions like that, because there's a lot of thought that has to go into that answer. It's not a simple yes or no.
There's four bands that all fall into a loose containment of shit that like really upsets me when I listen to it. And it goes Asia, Journey, Foreigner, and Kansas. If they went on a tour together, they would kill it because all those people listen to this, all that same bullshit.
Do you see the theme there?
They're going on a journey to Kansas, and then they're going to be a foreigner in Asia. All right. There's yes. a lot of ways to work that.
They're all travel-related.
Sam, what's up with that? Like, they're all travel-related bands. It's like Anthony Bourdain revisits bands of the 70s.
Boston, Kansas.
And that's our show. Europe. Remember to subscribe and share and like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Bass Travel Pod.
Later.
All right. Yeah, now, see, I was going to the ball game, my buddy Tom. We couldn't play Zigzag Wiggle Wham by the new Ball J Boys. What are they doing?